Okay, today we're going to look at Ruth. We finished Judges last week, and we're going to look at Ruth this week and next week, and then we'll be done, and we'll start a new quarter in the New Testament. The name of the lesson for this week is called Expressing Love, and it's going to cover verses in chapters 1 and 2 of Ruth. Does everybody realize that the events of Ruth took place during the period in Israel when they were in the time of the judges, that we just got through studying, that Ruth's story happened during that time? It's kind of contrasty from what we've been looking at that went on during that time. The book of Judges records, as we have just studied, violent, momentous events. But Ruth shows a peaceful, ordinary side of life at that time. So it wasn't always mayhem and trouble and things that we had looked at in the book of Judges. During this period, Israel had few political structures. The average person focused more on tribal and clan ties than on national identity. Most all the families in Israel depended on their own crops and animals for their food and other necessities. The book of Ruth records no miracles, but it's full of God's love. We studied the depressing cycle of the Israelites' disobedience in the time of the judges, making us wonder if there's any shred, if at any time during that time, you know, you don't really think about it, because all Judges is about so much turmoil and trouble that you don't think about that there was true faith, goodness, and basic decency somewhere in the world during that same time. The book of Ruth assures us there were people in the time of the judges that were truly devoted to the Lord. And we're going to look at some of those today. The book of Ruth teaches us that no matter how bleak the world around us seems to be, we can still make the choice to love one another and care about one another and love God. Ruth is the only book in the Old Testament that's named after a Gentile. Unlike the book of Judges, the Lord doesn't speak directly to anybody or through a prophet in the book of Ruth. But he did a lot of that in the book of Judges, if you remember. But the Lord's name is used 18 different times in these four chapters of Ruth, usually in the form of somebody giving a blessing in the name of the Lord to someone. So let's look at our first verses. The first section that we're going to look at is entitled Sacrificial Expression of Love. And we're going to look at Ruth 1, 11 through 13. It says, "But Naomi replied, 'Why should you go on with me? Can I still give birth to other sons who could grow up to be your husbands? No, my daughters, return to your parents' homes, for I am too old to marry again. And even if it were possible, and I were to get married tonight and bear sons, then what? Would you wait for them to grow up and refuse to marry someone else? No, of course not, my daughters. Things are far more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord himself has raised his fist against me.'" Those are some pretty harsh words and pretty detailed information about how she felt. And it goes to, we're going to talk about that, her words go toward the time that they lived in and the part of the country that they lived in. The book of Ruth opens with a familiar situation in the Bible during the Old Testament times, and that was a famine. When the land, no rain, no way to do their crops, so it forced people to make a move. And just like in Genesis 12, where Abraham moved, in Genesis 26, Isaac had to make a move. And in Genesis 42, Joseph's brothers, remember, they had to go because of famine. They went to Egypt. This was not uncommon for this to happen for these ancient people, who they needed pasture for their animals, and they couldn't raise crops without rain, just like, you know, we're having trouble now. A lot of the farmers are having trouble now across the country because of lack of rain. So Elimelech, his wife Naomi, and their sons Mahlon and Chilion. If I'm pronouncing them right or wrong, we'll just go with it. I'm doing the best I can. They moved from Bethlehem of Judah to Moab on the east side of the sea. And why he picked that city, who knows? But he did. But they move, and then he had the two sons, and they get married, and they marry Moabite women, Ruth and Orpah. But then Elimelech dies. And then 10 years later, both of his sons die. So Naomi knew, here she is. That's it. Her whole family is gone except for her daughters-in-law. So she knew that she had to go back home to where family was. And so she told them she was going to go, and the daughters-in-law wanted to go with her. But she wanted to send them back to their families. She gave them a blessing. It had two parts. It said, "May the Lord show faithful love to you as you have shown to the dead," meaning her sons and her husband, "and me." And then the other blessing that she gave them was, "May the Lord enable each of you to find security in the house of your new husband." Because that shows a testimony to Naomi's character. Number one, because the daughters-in-law wanted to stay with her. That shows what kind of person she was, and not go back to their families. They were in their home country, and they were near their families, but they were wanting, both of them, to go with her. So there's the relationship. We've got three women who love each other very much, their family, because of marriage. And so they want to go with her wherever she's going. So now let's talk about the verses that we just read. Because it's almost, for biblical times, for her to, just think about that. In today's times, pretty tame, the words that she used. But in biblical times, it could have been kind of embarrassing to listen to her talk about getting married again and having babies and them, you know, and all that stuff. But Naomi was living in a culture of herdsmen and shepherds for whom the facts of giving birth and nurturing to maturity, talking about raising them if she had some more, that was encountered daily through the way they made their living. So they could not afford to be squeamish about delicate matters of giving birth. Their survival depended on successful reproduction for themselves and their animals, and they spoke openly about it and without embarrassment. So during that time, what she said was just the way they were. But you think about, you know, it could have been kind of embarrassing to talk about that, but I guess in family it wasn't. In ancient agrarian cultures, men were expected to provide for and protect the women. So a female was first under the care of her father, and then her husband, and then her sons, if she had any. Ruth and Orpah were now without husbands. They didn't have any children. They never did get to have children before their husbands died. And they were away from their fathers. They lived in the same country, but not in the same area, I guess. So they didn't have, from the standpoint of the culture that they lived in, there wasn't any welfare for them to go on. There wasn't any respectable occupations for women back then. So for single women during this time, it was desperate. It would be considered a desperate situation. So this is a testimony to me to the strength of the three women that we're looking at in the book of Ruth. Naomi knew their only hope was to return home to their family and be in their father's house, and then have the opportunity to possibly find new husbands, because they were both young. The culture that they lived in also, listen to this, they also had the women bound to the family that they had married into. that if they stayed in that family, they could only marry a relative in that family. So it would have been disgrace. Typically, should your husband die, let's say, because I was thinking about this as an example, let's say Ruth's husband died, but Orpah's didn't. The in-laws were to provide another male from which that person could marry, or at least bear her a son that would grow up and take care of her when she got old. So possibly if Ruth's husband had died, but the daddy, Elimelech, was still alive, and Orpah's husband, then Orpah's husband probably, or either Elimelech, would have had to have helped by bearing a son that would take care of Ruth. So then the son, if she had one, would carry on the name of the deceased husband. And even though it wouldn't really be his blood. So it's kind of interesting, I thought. Equally important was that this son would take care of Ruth or whoever when she got old. This was a duty and a relationship that ancient people took very seriously. So I'd like for us to take a look at Genesis 38 for a familiar example of what this kind of culture caused people to do. So let's look at Genesis 38 real quick.
Chapter 38.
Yes, ma'am. This is just an example of the times. I just want y'all to really understand the times. It says, about this time, Judah left home and moved to Adullam, where he stayed with a man named Hira. There he saw a Canaanite woman, the daughter of Shua, and he married her. When he slept with her, she became pregnant and gave birth to a son, and he named the boy Ur. Then she became pregnant again and gave birth to another son, and she named him Onan. And when she gave birth to a third son, she named him Shelah. At the time of Shelah's birth, they were living at Kazib. In the course of time, Judah arranged for his firstborn son, Ur, to marry a young woman named Tamar. But Ur was a wicked man in the Lord's sight, so the Lord took his life. Then Judah said to Ur's brother, Onan, because of the Ur's gone, so there comes Onan. He says, go and marry Tamar, as our law requires of the brother of a man who has died. You must produce an heir for your brother. But Onan was not willing to have a child who would not be his own heir. So whenever he had intercourse with his brother's wife, he spilled the semen on the ground. This prevented her from having a child who would belong to his brother. But the Lord considered it evil for Onan to deny a child to his dead brother, so the Lord took Onan's life too. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, go back to your parents' home and remain a widow until my son Shelah is old enough to marry you. But Judah didn't really intend to do this because he was afraid Shelah would also die, like his two brothers. So Tamar went back to live in her father's home. Some years later, Judah's wife died. After the time of mourning was over, Judah and his friend Hira, the Adullamite, went up to Timnah to supervise the shearing of his sheep. Someone told Tamar, look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. Tamar was aware that Shelah had grown up, but no arrangements had been made for her to come and marry him. So she changed out of her widow's clothing. She'd been wearing widow's clothing all this time. And covered herself with a veil to disguise herself. Then she sat beside the road at the entrance to the village of Enam, which is on the road to Timnah. Judah noticed her and thought she was a prostitute since she had covered her face. So he stopped and propositioned her. Let me have sex with you, he said, not realizing that she was his own daughter-in-law. How much will you pay to have sex with me, Tamar asked. I'll send you a young goat from my flock, Judah promised, but what will you give me to guarantee that you will send the goat? What kind of guarantee do you want? He replied. She answered, leave me your identification seal and its cord and the walking stick you are carrying. So Judah gave them to her. Then he had intercourse with her and she became pregnant. Afterwards, she went back home, took off her veil, and put on her widow's clothing as usual. Later, Judah asked his friend Hira the Adullamite to take the young goat to the woman and pick up the things he had given her as his guarantee. But Hira couldn't find her. So he asked the men who lived there, "Where can I find the shrine prostitute who was sitting beside the road at the entrance to Enam?" "We've never had a shrine prostitute here," they replied. So Hira returned to Judah and told him, "I couldn't find her, and the men of the village claim they've never had a shrine prostitute there." "Then let her keep the things I gave her," Judah said. "I sent the young goat as we agreed, but you couldn't find her. We'd be the laughing stock of the village if we went back again to look for her." About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has acted like a prostitute, and now because of this, she's pregnant. Bring her out and let her be burned," Judah demanded. But as they were taking her out to kill her, she sent this message to her father-in-law. "The man who owns these things made me pregnant. Look closely. Whose seal and cord and walking stick are these?" Judah recognized them immediately and said, "She is more righteous than I am because I didn't arrange for her to marry my son Shelah." And Judah never slept with Tamar again. When the time came for Tamar to give birth, it was discovered that she was carrying twins. While she was in labor, one of the babies reached out his hand. The midwife grabbed it and tied a scarlet string around the child's wrist, announcing, "This one came out first." But then he pulled back his hand and out came his brother. "What?" the midwife exclaimed. "How did you break out first?" So he was named Perez. Then the baby with the scarlet string on his wrist was born, and he was named Zerah. So that's just I know it's a whole chapter, but I wanted you to get the idea of how seriously they took it and how wrong this family was to, in the eyes of the Lord even at the time, to not do what they were supposed to do. So let's go back to our story just to let you know that how desperate, truly desperate, the situation with Ruth and Orpah and Naomi were. So it gives us a better idea of where Naomi's coming from with the words in our first set of verses. She wanted them to see and understand how ridiculous it was for them to stay with her. You know, that they couldn't take care of one another, and she just wanted them to have a better life and go back and find somebody new. So because of the custom, as long as they were attached to Naomi, they couldn't look for other husbands to try to help to try to get married to. It had to be somebody that was a close relative of Naomi. So if they wanted another husband, their prospects were better if they went back home to their families. Then they could marry anybody that was acceptable to their family and acceptable to themselves. So Naomi's words in these first verses, they were not bizarre or crude in any way to Ruth and Orpah. Naomi wanted them to see the harsh truth of their future if they stayed with her. And you can't forget Naomi. Because of her age, her father, presumably, you know, it doesn't mention him, but he was probably already gone. And then she didn't have any husband anymore. And she didn't have any sons anymore to take care of her. So you'd think that with her daughters-in-law being the only people that she really had that was family to cling to, that she would have wanted to hold on to them. But that would have been a selfish act on Naomi's part and in her best interest and not theirs. So she showed strong character by trying to let them see that they needed to go back to their families. So let's look at our next verses. Declaration of commitment. Verses 15 through 17. "Look," Naomi said to her, "your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. You should do the same." But Ruth replied, "Don't ask me to leave you and turn back. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Wherever you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord punish me severely if I allow anything but death to separate us." So it would be easy to look at Orpah as maybe the bad one between the two. The one that, you know, tucked her tail and ran. But not really. based on what we've learned about their culture at the time that they were living in, she did not do anything wrong. She loved Naomi just as much as Ruth did, and she cried. She didn't want to leave her. She wanted to go with her, but she did what was best for Orpah at the time, which is what Naomi had encouraged them both to do. So, looking at Ruth now, and compared to Orpah, you see her as extraordinarily loving and loyal. In verse 15, Naomi is still trying to convince her to go back to her family, thinking that she's being foolish instead of loyal by doing that. Ruth's response in verses 16 and 17 showed that her loyal love trumped practical wisdom. She loved her so much, it didn't really matter. She was going with her, wherever she was going. In today's world, when the words commitment and loyalty, they send people running for the hills most of the time. But Ruth's words to Naomi serve as an example of what it means to be truly loving and strong under the circumstances. So let's look at demonstration of commitment in verse 18 of chapter 1. It says, when Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, she said nothing more. And then in chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. One day Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go out into the harvest fields to pick up the stalks of grain left behind by anyone who is kind enough to let me do it. Naomi replied, all right, my daughter, go ahead. So Ruth went out to gather grain behind the harvesters. And as it happened, she found herself working in a field that belonged to Boaz, the relative of her father-in-law, Elimelech. So even if Naomi still felt that Ruth was making a poor decision, she just simply said, okay, I'm done. I've done the best I can. If you're going, you're going. So she couldn't change her mind. So when they get back to Bethlehem, Naomi is spiritually and physically, she's just wore out. And she complained that God had made her life bitter. She was in despair. They were both completely, now that we got to think about the culture they're in. They're both widows with no men in their family to take care of them. So they're both completely on their own in this world that doesn't take too kindly to women being on their own. And so we look at Ruth. Her initiative to do something about their situation begins in chapter 2. So let's look at Leviticus 19 for a minute, because we want to see where all the rules and stuff are coming from. Leviticus. It's chapter 19, verses 9 and 10, and these are Leviticus 19. Okay. And this is some of the laws, the things that they had to go by. It says, when you harvest the crops of your land, do not harvest the grain along the edges of your fields, and do not pick up what the harvesters drop. It is the same with your grape crop. Do not strip every last bunch of grapes from the vines, and do not pick up the grapes that fall to the ground. Leave them for the poor and the foreigners living among you. I am the Lord your God. So those were laws and rules from God about how people were supposed to do. So that is helps you understand what she meant by going behind them. But everybody didn't obey the law. So Ruth was going to have to find a field to which she would be able to allowed to glean, which is going behind them and picking up the leftovers. That's how the Lord was trying to provide for people that couldn't take care of themselves. She was willing to face whatever embarrassment that this situation carried with it. Ruth is an extraordinary woman. And I was reading a book called The Gospel of Ruth. I read some of it this week when I was studying. And it was written by a woman, and it was just emphasizing that so many times when you study the book of Ruth, Boaz is the hero because he's the man that in the knight in shining armor. But Ruth is the hero, and Naomi, truly, for in the circumstances that Ruth was in, doing what she did, she's the heroine of the. And now Boaz, you know, it was great. God did that. But Ruth did what she, and you know, she wasn't, she took their God when she married into their family. She had gods with a little g from her family. So this is not something that she was born into and just knew. She learned it from them. And so that's another thing that shows us that God is at work. So this is where God begins his work. The field that she found just happened to belong to Boaz, who happened to be a relative of Elimelech, Ruth's father-in-law that had passed away. Now, if that's not God, nothing is. Taking her to that point. Boaz was not the nearest relative of Elimelech, so technically his obligation could have ended with allowing her to just glean in his field. He didn't have to go to all his extra trouble that he went to. But he was good, and he was godly, and he demonstrated in verse 4 of chapter 2, when he greets his workers. He says, while she was there, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. The Lord be with you, he said. The Lord bless you, the harvesters replied. So that shows you what kind of relationship he had with the people that worked for him. He took care of them. They respected him and he respected them. So let's look at rewards of commitment. Chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. This is Boaz. Yes, I know, Boaz replied, but I also know about everything you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. I have heard how you left your father and mother and your own land to live here among complete strangers. May the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge, reward you fully for what you have done. So Boaz gave Ruth permission to do to get all she needed from the field, just whatever. He even told them to leave some extra so she could pick it up. And y'all got to remember, I was looking in another book about the time, the biblical times, and this, what she was doing, this was not easy work. This was not something that even the harvest and just the people that were doing the work, but she was going behind them picking up the scraps.
It was back-breaking.
This was not an easy thing for her to do, and to be willing to do it for the survival of her and Naomi, and do it and take whatever she had to take. She's just an amazing woman. So Boaz's generosity was motivated by the character that he saw in Ruth, what she had done for Naomi and how she had stuck with her and for her being willing to come out here and do what she was doing. He had heard her story and was overwhelmed by her courage, her faithfulness, and her stamina. He knew how difficult it would have been for her to leave with Naomi everything and everybody that she had ever known. And he also knew that she didn't have to do it. She had the same opportunity Orpah did, but she decided to stay. He desired that God show favor on Ruth. He saw her belief in God as real, fully and completely real, a faith demonstrated by her devotion to Naomi. He affirmed that in his eyes, Ruth was now part of the covenant people and under God's protection. So I just think it's amazing. I just think she's an amazing person. And, you know, this gave me a little different perspective on Ruth than what you typically, because I have studied it, and they do give Boaz the hero award. But I really think it's more Ruth in this case, for all that she did under the circumstances that they lived in at the time. Does anybody have anything they want to add? Any questions or comments?
Wonderful lesson.